Hello, well, welcome to Group Chat, a weekly podcast on everything disability. Today with us, we have a very special guest. We have the Greens and Senator for Western Australia by the name of Jordan Steele-John. Jordan, how's it going?
Really, really good, my friend, and great to be here finally on Crip Chat.
Of course, we're going into now part three. So, Jordan, do you want to give a brief introduction of yourself?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, my name is Jordan Steele-John, and I'm one of the Australian Greens MPs at the national parliamentary level. I am currently the only kind of out and proud disabled MP in the parliament. I have cerebral palsy and use a manual wheelchair for mobility. And I do work in my role in the area of disability rights and justice, as well as in health, healthcare, particularly the campaigns of bringing dental and mental health into Medicare, which has long been a priority for the Greens, and also foreign affairs, peace and disarmament for the party. I'm the spokesperson in those spaces as well. So yeah, there's a broad scope of work that I do, but very much passionately committed to disability justice.
Yeah, no, it's always a pleasure to have you on board with us, Jordan. Just a question. Okay, let's get into it. How many Australian disability enterprises are currently operating in Australia? And are they meeting their obligations with the Fair Work Act and also the modern slavery reporting requirements?
Well, in terms of the baseline level of numbers of ADEs in Australia, the data at the moment is about 600 spread across the continent, with roughly 20,000 people engaged in by those providers. So that's the cohort, and that's remained relatively stable. And sometimes, fluctuates, but that's about the cohort that we're talking about, right? In terms of that very interesting question of do they comply with our obligations as a nation under the Modern Slavery Act? That is currently a question that is being explored by a number of academics and legal experts, because there's very strong and I think reasonable concern that they don't comply with relevant sections of that piece of legislation. And we do know very clearly that many people within Australian disability enterprises experience coercion, experience restrictive practices, and enter that way. Enter the ADE system via what some people call a kind of polished entryway, right? So you kind of slip into it from school, because maybe you're educated in a so-called special school in a segregated educational setting, for the equivalent of what do you want to do when you're older week. The ADE provider will come in and talk about the ADE. And then you naturally go from the school where you were segregated, the segregated setting there, through to the segregated workplace. And sometimes you then end up also in segregated housing, where you might be, in a dwelling with multiple members in it, all with disabilities as well, none of which whom you know. You're not able to have partners, you're not able to bring your family over, use your internet for what you want to use it for, like, and really you end up having a lot of your world confined by these institutional settings, with all of the dangers and all of the unhappiness that often comes from that.
Thank you for that, Jordan. Jordan, we often have these, I guess, these things happening, such as like disabled workers' rights at work, things like coercion, wage theft, and modern slavery. It's still happening out there. How do we close the legal loopholes used by employers to underpay their workers?
Well, I think it's a great question, Ibrahim. I think, first of all, we've got to be really clear about the context in which we're having this conversation, right? We've got in Australia the legalized underpayment of disabled people, 20,000 of us within the ADE system, many more external to the ADE system, but paid through the supported wage process, right? A process which relies on the it has a the SES award process, and it basically says, if you are assessed by a certain tool to have lowered capacity, you can be paid a proportion of what somebody would be paid for the job. Now, the primary tool that is used for the assessment of that fair proportion, if you like, is the BSWOT tool, which has been ruled to be illegal by the federal court. It's a discriminatory wage tool, and it was found to be so by the federal court. Andrew, help me out. Not the federal court. It's
Fair Work Ombudsman.
the Fair Work Ombudsman. There you go. Yeah, by
Mm-hmm.
the relevant national processes,
Mm-hmm.
right? So what we have is, by the way, I've got to just put a special pitch in for Western Australia. Even under that discriminatory tool, which structurally undervalued the workers' capacity, right? We've got Australian disability enterprises like Active Industries that still managed to engage in wage theft to the tune of a significant amount of money. So even in this cooked system, you've got ADEs that were still then able to rip people off, right? So when we talk about structural discrimination in the employment space for disabled people, it's important to tackle ADEs and the supported wage tool like structure broadly together, both as forms of discrimination, and be working towards a employment environment that fundamentally flips the script on this whole conversation. Talks about, first of all, how and where do we place the legal requirements upon employers to be inclusive in their employment practices? Is that, a strengthening of the Disability Discrimination Act? How else do we do that? How do we make our physical and digital workplaces accessible and inclusive for people, regardless of their physical support needs or cultural support needs, for instance? And then finally, in some ways, the disabled person, we as a disability community, with bodies and minds that refuse to conform to the norm, present an opportunity for the radical reconceptualization of so many parts of our society, right? Because we challenge the assumed wisdom. And one of the assumed wisdoms really centrally needs to be that you are only a valuable person if you can sell your labor in a market at an hourly rate that allows you to live, and that you should only be able to live and drink and eat and have a home if you can sell your labor in that way, which I think is absolutely nonsense, and why we need to look at things like a universal basic income, so that disabled people, if we don't want to actually engage in paid work, regardless of whether we could, if we actually don't want to, if that's not what works for us, we can actually live without having to engage in paid work in that way.
Yeah, that's a good point. We
Oh,
need
sorry.
more, I guess, disability representation in the workplace. Saying that, how are disabled workers represented in the workplace, Jordan?
Well, I think culturally we are represented in the workplace as charity cases still, overwhelmingly, right? So you'll see a disabled person in the workplace, on maybe an ad or whatever, and it'll immediately pivot to the story of the wonderful employer that made the changes to let them work there. Oh, it's so good of them. Somebody nominate them for an award. You know, there's that kind of like, we should be grateful for any opportunity that we get. So we're positioned in that way, as a charity case or as a burden. Most often, we are not, in fact, represented in the workplace at all in the broader cultural imagining. But you just don't imagine workplaces with disabled people in them, or if you do, you imagine them with one, like, you know, everybody else is da 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 da, and then look, there's Artie, the, you know, disabled, you know, he makes the coffee, or, you know, oh great, we just love everyone's friend, you know, the one disabled guy in the office, you know. We need to get to a space where disabled people are represented in employment as equal parts of the workplace, as workforce, as equitable parts of the workforce. And we get there by things like quotas that are enforced, for which those responsible for enforcing them are held accountable, and that accountability and the result of those processes are made public. So we really need to be applying some of those affirmative employment measures that have seen such success in areas like increasing cultural diversity and gender diversity in workforces, applied to the disability question too.
Yeah, awesome, Jordan. Finally, we talk about, you know, government regulations and their oversight. Who's investigating, you know, Australian disability enterprises to make sure they're compliant with the workplace and human rights laws?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. And again, that is not clear, right? In some ways, it is a responsibility of the NDIS Quality and Safeguards Commission. In other ways, you could argue it's a responsibility of various state-based occupational health and safety mechanisms, and the same federally too. But really, oversight, like, yes, is oversight important? Absolutely, oversight's important. But these are institutionalized settings, and therefore we know whether it's institutionalized housing, segregated and institutionalized education, segregated and institutionalized work. We know what happens in these places. People are abused, people are exploited, people are coerced, people are indoctrinated, right? Institutionalization is bad. It's a bad thing. Like, yes, we need oversight, but you're gonna go in there, you're gonna find a bunch of issues like that aren't the result of, you know, it's not the result of, oh, quick, Barry, go and put the light switch back in the socket, or, you know how we've been not, you know, treating people well, we should start doing that. Like, the culture of the place and the practices are a product of the setting. It's the same in aged care too, which is why reforming aged care without tackling the institutionalized nature of it will never work, because the abuses that you're experiencing, the maltreatment that you're documenting, is a product of the setting, you know, which is, anyway, bigger conversation. But yeah, so yeah, there's various different mechanisms, but ultimately, if you're having people together like that in those culturally and physically institutionalized settings, abuse will occur, is occurring, does occur.
That's a good point, Jordan. Still, is the Australian Disability Enterprise System sustainable and still a viable service type for people with disability?
No, it isn't. Okay. And like it is, it shares a lot with the fossil fuel industry, in as much as it is not a sustainable industry, which is rapidly losing its moral license, right? And so what is needing is a managed, proactive transition. I come from WA, and as I say, we have a large ADE provider, Active Industries, and they've just earlier this year gone up. We're closing. We can't make any money out of this anymore. We're closing. And that means that 700 people have suddenly found out that they don't have anywhere, like that this massive part of their daily routine is no longer a thing anymore. And there will be a big chunk of people that are like, okay, I didn't enjoy that anyway. I'd like to find work that pays me fully. But there are also people that have been there for 40 years or 50 years, you know, and have been that has been their routine for 40 or 50 years. There are many families that have rightly or wrongly planned their family members' support around their presence daily at an ADE, for instance. And so to throw that into chaos overnight through an unmanaged closure is not a good idea, and it shouldn't be what we're doing. What I think we need and what the Greens are arguing for is that managed, structured transition that supports those who want to into good paying supportive jobs and supports those that don't want to onto high levels of income support that they can actually live on. So an increased DSP, for instance, so that they can meet their financial needs that way, and then have the purpose and community that they might have sought from that setting met in other ways.
Awesome. Wow. Yeah, very insightful. Jordan, just finally, what do legislative reform measures would best be appropriate to bring about change in this important public policy space?
I think it's kind of a little bit of what I just mentioned. We need that managed transition. You know, like then we obviously need to get rid of the supported wage tool process, the SES process overall. Again, I just ask people to think about whether it would be appropriate to apply the same process to any other cohort of the workforce. Imagine if we did that. Imagine if we said, and we probably did used to say this, what we actually still do. I should say, but imagine if we do it. But, you know, there are many cohorts in our community, right? Or I shouldn't say cohorts, groups, whether it be women, trans folks, people of colour that suffer employment discrimination, that are the subject of unjustifiable wage differentiations, et cetera, et cetera. What the disability community experiences is a legally enforced, constituted, and promoted tool, which suggests that we can be measured, our capacity can be measured, just our ability to work, and then based on that we can be paid a bit less. Like, that doesn't exist anywhere else, as far as I'm aware. And if it doesn't exist anywhere else, it should be driven out of that space too. So we need to scrap that. We need to shift our culture and workforce more broadly. And also, as we do that, challenge ourselves to think about what we are actually building to, because it's my belief that what we really need to do, more like at the base of it all, is disconnect this fundamentally ableist idea that your ability to live a good life as a human being with the things that you need, like the essentials, a home, education, healthcare, water, food, community, should be tied to your ability to sell your labor at an hourly rate high enough to enable you to do that. We need to disconnect those ideas, because that is actually, I think, a structural a structural impediment to disabled people's economic freedom, you know, and enjoyment of a good life. So let's also take on this whole idea of work as the only pathway to being able to live as humans.
That was a very insightful, Jordan. Thank you very much for sharing, and thank you for allowing me to, I guess, pick your brain. It's been such an honor to interview you, Jordan. Any, I guess, final thoughts?
No, like that's about covered it. And a real pleasure to speak with you all about this really important topic. And yeah, thank you for the work that you do in promoting disability pride and supporting the community.
I was just going to add, there are some legislative things that we can do. Some of the problems with this process, especially with the Modern Slavery Act, is they only have to report if they earn over $100 million per year, and it's voluntary reporting. So of all the industries, including able-bodied industries that did report, I think only 70% met the threshold, and less than 20 actually reported their modern slavery requirements.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. I think that's a wrap, guys. Anyone want to have any questions?
Thank you so much. No, thank you for the invite. I've really enjoyed it.